Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Dan Glickberg here from Fairway Market with another delicious Thanksgiving tip. You do not need to serve your turkey piping hot. Let it rest before carving to keep the natural juices inside. As long as your gravy is hot, that'll do. For more Thanksgiving tips, log on to fairwaymarket.com.
You're listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Ann Saxelby. You're listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Ann Saxelby. You're listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Ann Saxelby, broadcast live to the cosmos on the Heritage Radio Network.
Welcome to another episode of Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Ann Saxelby. My co-host and producer is Sophie Schlesinger.
Hello.
And today we are very excited and thrilled and happy to have Rachel Dutton, who is a Bauer Fellow at the FAS Center for Systems Biology at Harvard University, here to talk with us. And just to give a little background about Rachel, I feel like most people in the world, well, a lot of people in the world anyways, when they think of bacteria and mold and gross microscopic things, they just kind of think yuck. But Rachel and her colleagues think something quite opposite. They love bacteria, and they actually have devoted their lives to the study of it, sort of mining these communities of microbiological activity. So Rachel, first of all, thanks so much for taking time out to be on the show.
Yes.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And so I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into loving bacteria so much.
Well, my background is that I'm a microbiologist. So I have my PhD in bacterial genetics. And for my thesis work, I studied E. coli and sort of basic biology of how bacterial cells work. But that was studying a single organism in a laboratory setting by itself. And so I got really interested in how that might be different from what microbes are actually doing out in the real world, which is not living by themselves in a lab. And so I became really interested in studying microbial communities. So these communities, when I say microbial communities, I'm talking about different species of microbes, so bacteria and fungi, living together in the same environment, and thinking about how these organisms might adapt to each other and interact with each other in a real-world setting.
That's super interesting. So how did you make the leap from being interested in how microbes interact with one another to identifying cheese as a good medium to study this activity?
Right. So the problem with microbial communities is that they're incredibly complicated. So if we think about the soil in your backyard or something that a lot of people are studying right now, which is the human gut, we have probably hundreds of species living together in a very complex environment. And so what eventually I'd really like to be able to do is understand exactly what makes these organisms tick and how things work. And so it's really hard to do that in such a complicated system. And so I was hoping to find some sort of environment that would have these interesting microbial communities, but is a little bit less complex and a little bit more controlled in a number of different ways and simplified. So that I was also really interested in food. Just personally, I love to cook and to eat.
Who doesn't?
And I was starting to learn a lot about food and food science, and you know, reading books like Carol McGee's on food and cooking, mm-hmm. and sort of just made the connection between these two passions of mine, which is microbiology and food, and realized that cheese is this amazing microbial environment where you are basically, you know, manipulating milk in ways to create the perfect environment for a certain set of microbes to grow and transform the milk into these amazing flavors and smells and textures that we love in cheese.
Wow. Cool. Yeah, it's it's so funny. It's like, you know, and the thing that makes it amazing is people have been doing it kind of without really understanding it to the level that you do for thousands of years. And I think now that you're going to start to really dig in and understand how these things all kind of work, or you said, you know, like you said, what makes them tick is really exciting. So I have to read this quote Sophie found, because I just really love it. It says, when you're eating the rind of a cheese, you're consuming more microbial cells than there are stars in the sky. Which I just think is brilliant. Was that a part of one of your papers or your essays on cheese?
Yeah, it was for an interview I did for Culture Magazine, which is all about cheese. And it's pretty incredible. We have these photographs of using scanning electron microscopy. So you're basically at the scale of the microbes themselves. So that a typical bacterial cell is only about a micron or two wide. So that's about a million times smaller than we are.
Wow.
So we need these very sophisticated technologies in order to just visualize these cells. So we did some scanning electron microscopy to see up close the communities, and it's just packed full of cells. It's the rind of cheese in particular, which is what we're really working on in the lab, is I think about as densely packed of a microbial community as you can imagine. Just cells on top of cells.
another quote to that effect that I really liked was that you guys you found that it was an exceptionally cosmopolitan community of microorganisms, which is a really funny way to think about it, you know, especially living in New York City, to think that, you know, the microbes are kind of doing what we're doing.
It's a really fun community, I guess, if you can call microbial community fun. It's what we're finding now on the rind of cheeses. So this is a microbial environment that hasn't really been very well characterized. We have a lot of knowledge based on culturing techniques that we've been using in microbiology for decades. But what we know from sitting in other environments is that you can't necessarily grow all of the organisms from an environment in the lab. Mm. So for soil, it's something like less than 1% of all of the species that are present in a gram of soil you can actually get in culture in the laboratory.
Wow.
But now we have sequencing technologies that allow us to... So what we do is we take the DNA out of the cells and we sequence small pieces of it. We target this one particular sort of fingerprint-like gene, this particular gene that gives us a sequence that will tell us what type of organism that sequence came from. And so we can actually get a snapshot of the entire collection of species that are present in any given microbial community. And so we're using this on cheese to just identify what species are there. And we're seeing organisms that have, you know, are not only found on cheese. They're found in many different environments, like the Arctic Ocean or sort of extreme environments like that. And they also happen to be participating in these communities on cheese.
Yeah, the other two that really stuck out when I was reading a little bit more of that article was that some of the microorganisms that were present had been found in Etruscan tombs and Tunisian oil wells.
So crazy.
It's really, really incredible. And, you know, what you're saying is also, you know, turning on its head, I think, sort of some traditional or conventional cheese wisdom, which is that, you know, Blumy Rind cheeses are made from Penicillium candidum and maybe sometimes Geotrichum. And washed rind cheeses are all Brevibacterium linens. And so you're finding that that is actually not true at all.
No, so yeah. So for the Blumy Rind cheeses, you know, they're usually inoculated with species, so people put in large amounts of the spores of Penicillium, so that, you know, the majority of what you're seeing on the surface is Penicillium, but there's probably a much more complicated set of species that are sort of underlying that initial layer. And then for things like the washed rind cheeses, we aren't actually finding Brevibacterium all the time, even though that's the one organism that we all know is supposed to be found on washed rind cheeses. And this has been seen also in a couple of studies in Germany and France, where they looked, you know, people are adding Brevibacterium linens as a starter culture, but they're not seeing it on the cheese as it ages. It's being apparently outcompeted by the local set of organisms that are making their home on the cheese.
And so where do these local organisms come from? I mean, obviously with milk, you're talking about an environment where there are plenty of microorganisms, but can you talk a little bit about what are some of the factors that influence where these communities come from in the first place?
Yeah, so we don't know for sure where they're coming from at this point, but my guess is that there's a couple of possible sources. One of them is the raw milk, and for the case of raw milk cheeses. And then you can also imagine, you know, once you make the cheese and put it in a cave or cellar to age it, you have microbes in that environment that are coming from the air and the surroundings that can then potentially colonize the cheese. So, or, you know, maybe it's even the cheesemakers themselves that are bringing in their cultures. We really don't have a good idea at this point where the organisms are coming from.
I love it. It's so mysterious, fascinating and cool. So I just think another aspect of your work that I think is really interesting, and I guess I said it a little bit at the beginning of the show, is that most people just think of all these things and they think, oh my gosh, like danger, like microbes, bad stuff. And you're more concerned with what are the beneficial aspects of this and how do they contribute to flavor?
Right.
So I was wondering if you could comment a little bit on that.
Right. So I think microbes get a bad rap for sure. I think it's because we only notice them when they're causing problems. We don't really notice all of the wonderful things that they do sort of in the background. You know, they're important for pretty much every ecosystem on the planet. And in food in particular, they play a huge role in all of these fermented foods. So that's, I think it's sort of a fun way to get people a little bit more excited about microbes versus scared of microbes. Because every single culture on the planet has some sort of fermented food. And the role that these microbes are playing, it's, you know, partly in preservation of the food. So the lactic acid bacteria in particular, these are bacteria that produce acid, which lowers the pH of foods and makes it so that many of the things that could potentially cause us harm can't actually grow in the food. So when you make something like sauerkraut or dill pickles, those are through the action of lactic acid bacteria producing acid when you're fermenting the food. And then we have all these other foods which, you know, in addition to preserving the food, completely transform the flavor and the texture and the smell of the starting material. So I think cheese is probably the best example of that, because every cheese started out as milk, which, you know, milk from a cow versus a goat versus a sheep tastes different, but nothing compared to the variety that you have and the flavors and textures of the final product of an aged cheese. And many of those flavors and textures are all coming from the action of microbes, whether they're the microbes growing inside the cheese or on the surface of the cheese. They're contributing all of these enzymes and metabolites that they're producing during the course of their growth, and those are the things that we're perceiving as all the interesting flavors of the cheese.
Wow. That's just, I don't know, it makes me smile. I have like a giant smile on my face. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the cheeses that you've focused on up until now and, you know, sort of what you've discovered.
So we've been spending a lot of time up at Jasper Hill Farm because it's a great place that has, you know, wonderful variety of cheeses. And they're really excited about the work we're doing there. So we've been going up there, collecting samples, bringing them back to the lab. One of the recent things that we've done is collecting samples during the entire aging period of Bailey-Hazen Blue.
Oh, wow.
So this is a natural-rinded blue cheese, and it forms this beautiful natural rind on the surface. It's not inoculated with any of these organisms that show up. And so we've been following how the community actually develops over time and what are the species that are present in the beginning versus the end, and how does that change? And can that tell us something about what are the important factors for how a community forms, or the important interactions for how a community forms. And so that's one of the projects we've been doing recently up at Jasper Hill.
Well, I was going to ask, and do you find there's consistency within, you know, these batches of Bailey Hazen? Do you find the same communities developing and changing and kind of, you know, dying off and then forming other communities? Or is each batch kind of its own story?
So we don't have enough data yet to really know that. We know that within a batch of cheese, the communities are very, very similar from wheel to wheel. And we do have a couple of data sets for Bailey that suggest that, at least on Bailey, it's very similar over time, the rind community. But that may not be the case for other cheeses. I mean, cheesemakers know this, that their cheese is not always the same depending on, you know, many different factors, whether it's the season or something about the temperature or the way they made that particular batch of cheese, you can sort of make the cheese go in different directions. We don't really know yet. But my sense is that if the cheese looks and tastes the same, probably the microbial community is going to be the same.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I cut you off. I'm sorry. You were going to say something else about you were studying the aging profile and how things change, and then something else?
Yeah, and so the other thing we are doing in the lab right now is collecting many, many samples of cheeses from around the world, because we want to do the sort of survey of what different species are present on different cheeses, and different styles of cheeses. How different is the rind community from a natural rind to a bloomy rind to a washed rind? And how different is a washed rind that's made, say, in Vermont versus in France? And so we're just trying to collect as many different types of cheeses as we can right now, and profiling what types of species are present in these different cheeses.
That sounds like a super fun project.
Yeah, I could definitely do that lab work, I think.
Yeah, the collecting samples is fun. We just went to Italy to the Slow Food Cheese Festival in Bra.
So cool.
Where we had access to all these amazing and interesting cheeses that we would never see in the United States. And a lot of raw milk cheeses and a lot of just very traditional cheeses. And processing the samples is a lot of work.
Yeah. How did you get it all back here? Did you have any trouble getting any cheese from outside the U.S. to the lab?
Yeah, so we were pretty certain we wouldn't be able to get the cheeses back into the U.S., at least not everything. We collected about 200 samples.
Wow.
So we worked with a collaborator at the University of Parma, and we actually took all of our samples there first and extracted all of the DNA from them and shipped that back.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Crazy.
That's way smarter than just crossing your fingers and hoping that the dogs don't smell it.
Yeah. It would have been a pretty stinky piece of luggage.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so can you tell us, what were some of the most interesting cheeses that you saw, you know, just on the outside from your trip to Italy? What were some of the weirdest and most unusual or fun?
Yeah, so I have a couple of cheeses that really stood out. One was an Italian cheese made in the Piedmont region, and it was called, I think, Montebore, and it looked sort of like a birthday cake. so it had like this three-tiered layers of different sizes of cheese, and then it was a completely natural rind early on, you know, a couple weeks or months old. It looked like a very sort of the wrinkly geo rind on the surface. Mm-hmm. And then they had different ages, and as it aged, it started to dry out and flatten out and get sort of this reddish orange rind on it. And then later on, it got even more flat and started to look like a cow pie and was brown.
And this was the intended affinage?
Yeah, apparently. I was pretty shocked because we would never see anything like that in the U.S., and I was talking to the people who were going to the stand and asking them, is this typical of the region? And the one woman I talked to said, oh, yeah, you'll see this in the shops around here, and people buy it all the time. And
not just for birthdays.
Yeah. No.
Yeah.
So that one was pretty interesting. And then there was another booth there where they had all of these little tiny cheeses that looked like biscuits or bagels or crackers, or, you know, they were just
Wait, I've seen that guy. Was he? He was from the Aquitaine region
of France? Yeah, and they, you know, they're just like these dried out little cheeses that I think were probably covered in cheese mites. And they had them up, they were like 2 to 5 years old, and it was kind of incredible that they were still, you know, they when you sliced into them, they actually looked and tasted like cheese.
I brought one of those home with me in 2009, and I think it sat in my refrigerator for another like 6 months because I was just like, well, I don't know if today's the day I want to eat it. They're pretty intense.
It was pretty intimidating.
Yeah. Oh, that's really amazing. So I was wondering, how big is your team, and how long do you see? What's kind of the scope of this project?
Yeah.
So I have two postdocs working with me in the lab. So it's a pretty small lab. And I have 5 years here. So it's, you know, a decent amount of time to get this research going. But we really are in the early days right now, so we have a lot of work still to do.
Absolutely. And so you were talking a little bit in the beginning of the show that there were some other people doing similar research, perhaps in European countries or other places. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about that. Who's your community?
Yeah, I was going to ask that too. And is there anyone else in the U.S. doing some cool research about cheese?
So one of the best, I think, cheese microbiology bodies of work that has come out from the U.S. is from Sister Noella Marcelino, so the cheese nun, who I'm sure you've heard about before. But
she's great.
I think, was one of the first people to start thinking about this as, you know, a microbial ecosystem and thinking about it more in an ecological context versus just an industrial and applied sense. So unfortunately, there's not too many people right now, at least in the U.S., doing this sort of research in terms of thinking about cheese as a way to learn about biology and a way to learn about microbiology. There's a lot of really fantastic research that goes on about, you know, pathogens that are present in cheese and how to improve the quality and safety of cheese, but not a whole lot of basic research. And there's a bit more of it in Europe, because I think there's more funding for doing this sort of work there.
That's interesting. And it seems like a little bit more tolerance, too, for the idea of microbes in general.
Possibly.
That's really, really incredible. So do you see yourself continuing this this research after the 5 years? Can you think of like a phase two that would be like the dream job, or do you see yourself moving on to a different kind of microbial community?
No, I love cheese. I hope to keep doing this for a while. I think there's enough to keep me occupied for many lifetimes. So. Yeah.
It seems like it. Absolutely. And so if people want to learn more about your research, how can they do that? The article in Culture seems like a good place for people to start.
Definitely.
Yeah, there's the article in Culture, and there was just an article in the Boston Globe that Rowan Jacobson wrote. Rowan is an author that he wrote The Geography of Oysters and American Terroir. So he wrote a really nice article in the Boston Globe about the research we're doing a couple weeks ago. And I'm hoping to put a website together for my lab, but I haven't had the time to do it yet.
I don't understand. I can't even imagine the intricacy of all that, you know, work, the sequencing and everything.
I feel like I'm really missing out because I've only seen cheese with the naked eye and eaten it. I need to take some like close-up photos. And
you should check out the photo. Are the photos also part of the Culture article?
Yeah, there was another. I did I took some images of colonies from cheese microbes, and that was published in Culture magazine also. So people can find those on the web.
Cool.
That's really fascinating.
Come up.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show. It's been a real, real pleasure talking with you and hearing all about this microscopic world that we all love but don't think of very often.
Thank you.
So I have one final question. So if people ask you, can I eat the rind? What's your response?
If you like the way it tastes, I would eat it. If not, don't eat it.
That's good what answer. I always say too. You heard it from the expert.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Rachel. And we will be with you all again next Monday for another episode of Cutting the Curd.
Yep. Bye.
You're listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Ann Saxelby. You're listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Ann Saxelby. You're listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Ann Saxelby, broadcast live to the cosmos on the Heritage Radio Network.